Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves.
And I'm Don Bishop. We're your hosts tonight for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Landon Mayer, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for big, huge, monster trophy trout. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you would like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question promptly, and we're trying to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight.
This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form.
When we return, we'll be talking with Landon Mayer about fly fishing for those monster trophy trout.
The Nantahala River in western North Carolina, near the Great Smoky Mountains, is a renowned destination for whitewater adventurers and fly fishing fanatics. It also offers some one-of-a-kind privileges, such as being one of the nation's top trout streams, night fishing, and last but not least, Mystic River, the only whitewater riverfront community in the eastern U.S. The promise of an unrivaled setting can be yours if you act fast. Mystic River on the Nantahala is releasing its final 15 home sites of this natural treasure. Now is the last chance ever. Call 866-977-4455 or visit mysticriverland.com. That's 866-977-4455 or online at mysticriverland.com. Well, before we introduce Landon, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away, thanks to Landon, a copy of his autographed new book, How to Catch the Biggest Trout of Your Life. We'll also be giving away a 3-year membership of the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 3 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage and look for the link under Landon's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show.
Tonight our guest is Landon Mayer. Landon is a fly fishing guide in the Colorado Springs, Colorado area, and he calls the South Platte River his home water. He's been guiding on these waters for the past 10 years, and he also has a 1-year experience in Alaska with Knack Neck anglers. Passion and love for the sport of fly fishing is what moves Landon. His success in catching trophy trout is fueled by an addiction for pursuing large trout with small flies and lightweight fly fishing equipment. Landon also displays enthusiasm in teaching and demonstrating his techniques and on-river knowledge to fellow anglers. Through trial and error and perseverance, he has developed innovative techniques for hooking and landing selective trout. He's sharing these techniques and secrets in a book titled How to Catch the Biggest Trout of Your Life, which is published by Wild River Press, and his DVD, Landing the Trout of Your Life with John Barr, is produced by Mad Trout Media. Landon Mayer is a contributing writer for High Country Angler magazine, as well as major publications such as Fly Fisherman and American Angler. He currently teaches several fly fishing classes and gives presentations on his techniques. He's an ambassador for Cloud Veil Fly Fishing Apparel and a member of the Ross Reels and Rio Pro Staff. Landon, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, Landon, it's good to have you. And,
absolutely.
First, before we tell the folks what we're going to be covering tonight, how was fishing today? I heard you were out on the river.
Fishing was good. I was actually up on one of the reservoirs that has recently been drained and just opened up this year in South Park called Antero Reservoir, and there's some strong, healthy fish that love to take you to your backing and also like to break you off in the weeds, but fishing was good until the storms rolled in and the drive back was fine. So, yeah, things were great today.
Well, good, good. Glad you had a good day. It looked a little dicey up there over the mountains from where I can see. But,
yeah. Yeah, this time of year that lightning can play tricks on you, so you definitely got to be safe.
Yeah, right, right. Well, one of we're going to cover a lot. We've got, just a wealth of questions, thanks to our listeners. I mean, we've got questions from Colorado, Idaho, Nova Scotia, Canada, Vermont, Wyoming.
North Carolina and England and Argentina.
Right, Kansas, California. I mean, just all over the place. So
that's great response. That's exciting.
So, yeah, a great international audience as usual. We're going to try to cover a lot of Landon's techniques and what he's well known for is sight fishing to big trout. And so hopefully we can all learn a bit about his techniques and his experiences. One of the first questions I thought was kind of interesting, Landon, was this is from Jim in Littleton.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you are so young, but you have a wealth of knowledge about fishing. How old were you when you started, and what was your major source of information?
I was about 8 or 9 years old when I first started to really get into the sport, and would go up with my mom and my brother and friends of the family, leisurely have some fun on the water, and after that, met some people along the way and started to get some information from them as well. One of the big inspirations for me when I was very young was some videos that were out at the time, one in particular by Doug Swisher, which was Mastery Series with 3M. And above and all, the being on the water, just time spent on the river, was my biggest source of information.
Did you have any mentors, per se, on the water when you were first getting started?
You know, my brother was probably my biggest mentor. And, you know, just any angler I'd see on the water performing well, I wouldn't hesitate to go up and ask them a question, you know, what they're using, how they're doing. Of course, watching the videos with Doug Swishers and trying those techniques and seeing them work on the water as well. So I think being out there in the environment and meeting all the great people that enjoy this sport and enjoy getting outside and doing it was really the inspiration and helped me with learning a lot of information along the way.
Landon, one of our listeners wants to know if you think there's a significant peak size difference between species. For example, rainbows, do they get bigger than browns?
You know, that's a great question. I think that rainbows have the potential to get larger than browns when it comes to girth, when you're dealing with how fat the fish will get, per se. I believe that the browns tend to be more lean, hard-body fish. The rainbows tend to put on more weight, and the browns tend to put on more length. So it's hard to say which one can grow the largest. I know this year a new world record rainbow was caught at 44 pounds, and the pre-existing record for brown trout is 40 pounds, and same with Lahontan cutthroat. So I think that the rainbows tend to be fatter, but the browns tend to be longer and leaner. So I'd say for sheer girth and weight, I think that you're going to have a better shot with a rainbow than you do a brown or any other species.
Okay. And do you take advantage of differences in behavior between male and female trout in terms of influencing your fishing techniques?
Oh, absolutely. Female trout tend to group up in numbers and pods, and they tend to hold together in deeper runs and sometimes also in shallow runs. Your male trout are more independent and aggressive and tend to move around the water independently, and you won't find them podded up together in deep holes or runs. So, yeah, there's definitely a big difference in how you can approach each species. I think that your best shot for a trophy trout is without question going to be a male at the beginning of the season, and as the season progresses in the spring, fall, summer, or winter, you'll have more shots at the female just because the males are the first ones to enter shallow water and the first ones to become territorial.
Now, there you're talking about primarily the rainbows and cutbows as spring spawners, right, in relationship to the spawning activity?
You know, it's in relationship to spawning activity, but it's also in relationship, for example, up in Alaska when you get the rainbows and the other species of fish to move up and actually eat the eggs off of the salmon when the salmon are spawning. So there's numerous things that will drive fish to migrate or move. The first and foremost, of course, is spawning, followed by food source. And I think one of the biggest forgotten reasons for fish to migrate or move about within any waterway is pressure, whether the pressure is from a natural predator from above like bird of prey or pressure from anglers like ourselves on the river's edge.
Okay, so when we're talking about, I mean, I suppose this is going to be different depending on where in the world you are with the same fish. Like you said, Alaska, you combine that with the salmon spawn.
Sure.
Whereas in Colorado, you don't necessarily have that salmon spawn, or maybe
exactly.
Down the Great Lakes, you do have a salmon spawn there as well. So,
sure.
So it sounds like it might be location specific then.
It is location specific as far as if the fish are moving because of spawn or because of feeding. That's definitely true. Fish will move and spawn in every waterway they live, whether it's reservoir or river, but you know, there are specific areas where they'll move to spawn and move to feed. You know, timing's the most important thing when it comes to fish migrating, so that those are two big factors in when to be on the water and knowing that the fish are going to be there.
Lyndon, Kim in Rexburg, Idaho, wonders about the moon phases and their effect on trophy-sized fish. I'm assuming that you do some fishing after dark, but basically wondering about full moon and new moon effects on fish feeding.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I do think it plays an effect. I don't think it's so much for how the fish are going to feed. I think that's based more on gravitational pull and when the fish are going to move. For example, in upstate New York, I happened to arrive right after a full moon and was also there 3 days prior to the full moon fishing. And the 3 days prior, fishing was average, and there were a few fish moving around. After the full moon, the number of brown trout within the waterway almost tripled. So I do think that plays a big factor as far as fish moving. And in terms of fish feeding based on full moon and new moon, with a full moon, the sky and everything around is lit up, so there's more light, and I think that gives fish more advantage to stalk their prey, especially brown trout who tend to be nocturnal feeders. So I think your best shot at moon phases for fish to be actively feeding would definitely be full moon.
So do you think a person is advised to consider near dark, either late or dark or early morning hours in terms of pursuing large fish?
Yeah, great question, too. You know, early morning's good. The problem with early morning is as water temperature increases with the difference with the air temperature, there's a lot of steam on the water, so it makes sight fishing for the trout somewhat difficult, and also your water temperatures tend to be increasing at that time. My personal favorite time to pursue trophy trout in any waterway I've ever fished is definitely when the sun is going down. I think at dusk is one of your best shots just because there's no mist on the water. The temperatures are starting to cool off after they had heated up during the day and gives the fish a chance to move around without feeling any pressure. You know, a lot of the basis on early morning, late afternoon, and stormy conditions is it falls back on fish feeling safe with whatever waterway they're in. If they don't feel pressure from above and they feel safe that they have cover, which they can get from low light conditions or cloudy conditions, that's going to make the fish more apt to eat and more apt to take your fly.
Well, I'd like to kind of follow up on what you said about temperature. Thomas Burchell in Halifax, Nova Scotia, asks, how does water temperature affect the gear you use when summer fishing, and how does it affect the feeding habits? And I want to kind of add to that and say, when we were fishing down on the San Juan River in New Mexico, we went out one morning trying to beat all the guides, you know, by getting out there an hour earlier in the morning, getting our boat down there and so forth. And we fished for the whole hour and nothing was happening. It was really slow.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the guide boats came, then the fish kind of woke up. And I was wondering if that had to do with change in temperature, for the day. So
absolutely.
Could you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, the summertime is especially important when it comes to temperatures. Early bird gets the worm. That doesn't really hold truth in fly fishing, because for these insects to become active, for the hatch to start happening on the waterway, you need heat. And getting there early in the morning, there's less bug activity. So I like to tell my clients and think of it myself as banker hour fishing. That's one of the great things about fly fishing during the summer months, is that you can get to the water at 8 o'clock and get off the water by 3 or 4 o'clock, and you've pretty much hit prime time, allowing the, water temperatures to warm up, the bottom of the river to warm up, the insects to become active, the trout to warm up, and temperatures of water. When everything comes together, that's when the trout tend to feed. And I find a lot of anglers on the water very, very early in the morning thinking they're going to beat the trout, and the same thing happens. They get on the water, they see some fish, they have a little bit of activity, but a certain hour hits, that magic hour hits at 9 or 10 o'clock and the trichos start to bloom, or 11 o'clock comes around and the PMDs start to pop. Those are the magic hours you want to time for when you're trying to fish during the summer months. So knowing what temperature is ideal for the insect that you're trying to pursue as far as what you're going to imitate during the summer months is very important.
Okay, Landon, I'd like to go back a little and discuss a little bit more about the spawning activity.
Mm-hmm.
Because in your book, you go into great detail about the specific activity of both sexes, during that time.
Sure.
And also you might touch upon, the ethics of fishing for them during the spawn. Because realistically, that's one of the best times, whether it's spring or fall, to target a trophy trout, right?
It absolutely, and not just trophy trout. If you think about all the game species of fish that are pursued on fly rod throughout the world, almost all of those fish are pursued during their migration or when they're preparing to spawn. Whether you're fishing for tarpon on the flats that are coming up from Cuba, or whether you're fishing for steelhead that are migrating up from the ocean, all those fish are doing it when they're getting ready to spawn. And that plays a huge part in being able to have a chance at these fish. Because a lot of the trophy trout within the U.S. and abroad across the world live in large bodies of water or reservoirs or oceans, you don't have months throughout the year to pursue them. You have to basically wait for the fish to get ready to move into water that's suitable for a fly fisherman or angler to pursue them. And as far as ethics are concerned, it's very important to try to fish the two main stages where you can be successful without hurting the trout. And the most important stage, and my favorite stage, is the pre-spawn stage. That's when the fish first come into the waterway. They're not worried about spawning. They're worried about migrating, and they're worried about location, where they're going to hold, what territory they're going to guard. And the next one would be the post-spawn. After they have spawned, fish are less wary. They need to eat to replenish the nutrients they lost when they were spawning. And being able to pursue the fish during those two time frames during the spawn is going to make you successful and give you good fishing ethics on the water. While fish are spawning, you can get close to them. I've even been in many river situations where you can almost walk on the fish while they're actively spawning, because they're not worried about predators and they're so aggressively trying to perform their ritual that people will often cast at them. But I will say without doubt that 90% of fish that are actively spawning will not feed. And the only way you're going to get a fish to hit while they're spawning is out of aggression, to try to move something off of their bed or the water where they're trying to spawn.
Yeah, that's something that we hear repeatedly. Let me just ask, Landon, when we move from the spawning phase for the spring spawners on into the summer, where do the big fish go? Where do you locate them?
You can locate some of those fish will hold in the deeper runs where they feel safer, a little bit more cover. You can pursue them early morning, late evening. You won't have as much access to them during the day. And if you're dealing with inlets or tailwaters, then you have the chance of pursuing those fish back in the reservoir itself. But quite honestly, 50% of these fish, after they've come in to do their spawn or they've come in to feed on other species that are spawning, you lose 50% of your chance of pursuing the trophy trout. That's why the timing and being on the water is so important during the different seasons. There's some rare cases where you get fish that will actively feed all year long and you can pursue trophies. And with that in mind, you're just going to look for areas of water where they're going to find cover and they don't have to expend a lot of energy to obtain their food. Trout are very lazy by nature. They will expend energy to obtain food, but they have to be replenished with nutrients that's lost once they do gather that food. So that's when you're dealing with streamers, mice patterns, you know, any large food source or protein source that the fish can key in on.
Sure, sure. Well, you mentioned sight fishing, and we're going to want to elaborate on that, but first let's take a very brief break. When we return, we'll be talking more with Landon about sight fishing for those trophy trout.
Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's M-A-G. That's www.flyfusionmag.com, and start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Landon Mayer about fly fishing for those big, huge, monster trophy trout we all dream of. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A textbook to send us your question. We'll receive your question promptly, and we're working hard to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Landon, you mentioned a little bit about what you did up on Antero Reservoir today. Tell us a little bit about what all you have available and what you guide there along the South Platte and in the Colorado Springs area.
Sure. My home waters are, of course, the South Platte. Preferably my favorite section of the South Platte drainages is the Dream Stream section up on the Spending Mountain Ranch area. I have access of guiding at all four locations near Colorado Springs, 11 Mile Canyon, Cheeseman, Deckers, and Spenny. I guide with the my home shop, the Peak Fly Shop in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and in Woodland Park. I also guide with Colorado Fishing Adventures out of the Broadmoor. I do some private trips up to the Yampa River, which is in Steamboat, Colorado. I do a variety of trips primarily for trout, not just for trophies, but trout during all seasons, drives, nymphs, streamers, and every discipline. I've pursued pike with clients, carp with clients. Pretty much I eat, sleep, and breathe this sport, so I try to pursue everything I possibly can. And a lot of the information that anybody would like to know about rates or anything like that, you can get from my website, which is landonmayer.com, www.landonmayer.com. It's got the Peak Fly Shops logo on it, Colorado Fishing Adventures logo on it, and that's how you can gain the information for rates and time frame, trips, what type of trip, what time of year, that type of thing.
Great. Well, and I think it'll be easy for people to see the passion in your book and your DVD when they get those. Well, let's get back to the subject at hand. You mentioned sight fishing for these big trophies. Tell us exactly what you mean by sight fishing.
Sight fishing is something I hold very dear. Sight fishing to me is basically trying to obtain a visual in any way possible for every discipline of fly fishing in any waterway that you're fishing. Whether it's dry flies on the surface and determining if the fish is eating a mayfly, a caddis, an emerger, the size of the fish that's rising, fish in subsurface conditions, if they're chasing a streamer, why are they chasing the streamer, watching them chase the streamer, nymphing to fish that I can see, sight nymphing, which is huge because for so long in this industry, everybody relied on drag-free drifts with long swings and long runs, and the indicator on their leader became the most important thing. And, you know, I've had too much of that and got to the point where I said, hey, you know, the best indicator is the trout, and this is the best way to pursue it. And the exciting thing about sight fishing and all those disciplines is how exhilarating that visual is, and how much you learn from the trout's behavior. Trout don't just feed by opening their mouths. They have different movements for different things they're eating. They react differently during different hatches, and it's just such an exciting way to fish that keeps you active all day and keeps you addicted and wanting to come back for more.
Well, we'll get into some details about how you do that, because I think you've got some excellent techniques. But I'm gonna start a little bit, you know, more basic than that, which is, you know, I come to a stream, a river. How do I even know if there are any big fish in there?
You can do that by reading the river itself. You know, everybody is, when they first start fly fishing, one thing that you're going to learn if you haven't already is that reading water is a very important tool to be able to locate fish. And every river is going to hold a trophy fish, whether the trophy is 12 inches and the rest of the fish you're catching are 8 inches, or it's 10 pounds and the other fish you're catching are 5 pounds. The way to locate these fish is to find areas where they can easily obtain their food without having to worry about predators above, and look for certain areas like undercuts under the bank, structure in the middle of the river, log jams, rocks, boulders, fallen trees, anywhere where that the fish can hold and obtain the food without having to use any energy to get it. A good example of that is, you know, a lot of these fish in these large rivers throughout the U.S. will actually move up to the area where they stock fingerling rainbow trout, and the fish have a timing down to where they know when they're going to stock, or they hear the commotion of the fish being dumped into the water, and they'll move up into that location and simply sit there and feed. But I think the most important way that you can know if there's a trophy in the water is trying to find the ideal situation. And to make it ideal, you need three things. First is cover. Second is food. Third is oxygen. If you have those three things, if you look at a piece of water and say, okay, yeah, I can get cover, oxygen, and food supply in this run, there's a chance that a trophy is going to hold there. And if you look in that waterway, try to find an area where a trout could hold without expending any energy to obtain its food, and oftentimes not, you're going to find a trophy.
I find it interesting what you said when you said every stream holds a trophy trout, whether it's 12 inches or 10 pounds.
Exactly.
That's a very good answer to my question, because, I mean, we have to realize that not every stream has a 10-pound trout in it, based upon, I guess, the nutrients available, the depth of the water, the season that it has to, you know, go through up there. Maybe it's, you know, high mountain stream or something that's much colder most of the year or something like that.
Right. Yeah, if it's catch and release or put and take. And, yeah, there's many things that come into play. And you'll find that most areas that do hold true giant fish that will break the 10-pound mark, they either have a lot of area to travel, meaning they're going back to a large body of water, or the river system they're residing in has an unusually high supply of protein for them to grow to those large proportions.
Another just side note, and I think it was Joe Butler that was telling me about catching big trout, and he said one of his... a good technique is if you see a stocking truck come in with stockers and everybody's immediately trying to fish for all the stocked fish, you know, all the 8, 12 inchers and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He says, just sit back, rest, come back about an hour later, and then all the big fish will be coming in to eat all the stockers, and that's when you can catch your trophy trout. So it's kind of what you were saying, too.
Yeah, and that's been the case, for example, in the Ozark fisheries on the White River, the North Fork of the White and the Little Red. Those 40-pound browns are able to gain that size and girth because instead of having their main diet be insects mixed with bait fish, they're actually eating stocked fish and dead shad that are floating downstream. So they're almost quadrupling every bite with protein rather than one insect. So that does play a huge part.
Yeah. Landon, I was impressed by your DVD in terms of sight fishing, that you actually lay eyes on a particular fish and then target that animal for, you know, for a capture, if at all possible.
Absolutely.
And it appears to me that you have a remarkable facility for that. Can you give us some tips on identifying, you know, the physical presence of that big fish?
As far as what you're looking for?
I presume you identify the target area, the three components that you talked about.
Sure.
But oftentimes you would see the fish on your DVD. You would point out to John Barr, okay, right up there, you know, and that's what I'm wondering. How do those of us who go to a stream and never lay eyes on a big fish, how do we train ourselves to see those?
A great question. And first off, the hardest skill learned in fly fishing is sighting trout. A lot of people would like to be able to go out to the water and learn this skill and be able to use and implement it on every other fishing trip they go on, but time and perseverance is what's going to allow you to see more trout. Basically, don't leave the river or try not to leave a waterway until you see a fish. That way you know what a fish looks like in different waterways or different water conditions. Clear water, dirty water, you know, bright water, low light water. And one of the most important things, the first and foremost, is what you're wearing as far as sunglasses. You need to have the right lens to cover your eyes to be able to see into the water. And my personal favorites and one of the biggest questions I'm asked is, what tint do I use for lenses? And I prefer Silver Creek Brown or copper. The reason for this is it's dark enough during bright days to where you can see into the water, but yet it's light enough for dark days to see into the water. So you have the equal in between. Instead of amber, to where it's very light all the time, or gray, where it's very dark all the time, copper and silver is your even in between. And also having side shields, something that covers the sides of your eyes, not just the front of your eyes, but the side, because the side glare is what really keeps you from being able to look into the water without having to squint or without having to unfocus or focus your eyes at the wrong time. The model I use is Fishbone from Smith Optics, and the reason I choose that model is because I get those side shields. And the most important thing that you can do on the water when you're scanning or looking for a fish is try to look for the fish with unfocused eyes. Don't focus in on one specific area. Keep your eyes unfocused so you can detect movement. You can detect a silhouette or something looking unnatural from the bottom, and that will give you a better shot at being able to actually see the fish in the water.
Oh, those are great tips, and your discussion on polarized glasses is right on the money for Bob Nunn, who divides his time between New Jersey and Vermont. Can tell me this, are smaller fish tougher to spot than bigger fish?
Absolutely. And it's not always the case, but a lot of the times they are. The reason is they move quick, so if the fish does spook, there's a good chance you're not going to see the smaller fish because they move faster on a regular basis than the larger trout, and I think they tend to be a little bit more camouflaged because they're not trying to show dominance, and the size of their body is not going to show color or markings as well, so smaller fish can be harder to see for sure. One thing to remember, too, is you know, when you're looking at these fish in the water, you're looking down at a 45-degree angle. So the most important thing to remember is that the camouflage of the trout is its back and from its lateral line up. That's what the fish is resembling on the river bottom or the water conditions that it's living in. That's why steelhead that come out of the ocean are chrome, because there's no color on the bottom of the ocean. They don't have to camouflage with any river bottom situation. And then you go with the rainbows, let's say at the Taylor River in Colorado, or the brown trout up on the Dream Stream. Those fish have to camouflage with the color of the rocks or the color of the river bottom with how they look and how they're able to hide.
Landon, in your book, when you talk about sight fishing, you talked about viewing lanes. Can you explain what you mean by that and how you use that technique?
Absolutely, yeah. Viewing lane is without question, your most important and first thing you want to try to find when you're on the water. It's not the best way to look for the fish, but you need to find a viewing lane to be able to even look. A viewing lane is a section of water that you can clearly see into. It can, you know, be 5 to 8 feet in front of you, or it can span all the way across the river. A viewing lane can be caused by sun. And a viewing lane can be caused by shadow from a tree on the opposite side of the river. A viewing lane can be caused from a storm system moving in from far away that's casting dark shadows on top of the water. So viewing lane is basically a section of water that you can clearly see into that allows you to scan the water as you move up or downstream looking for that fish or looking for that trophy fish. So if you're fishing in sunny conditions, put the sun at your back so you're not having to fight glare and reflection off the water surface. If you find a tree on the opposite side of the river, wait till the time is right when the shadow is cast onto the river from that tree, and that cast of that shadow during bright conditions is going to allow you to see into the water better because there's going to be no glare.
All righty. Well, we have a question that John, who's lives on some trophy water in Saratoga, Wyoming, wants to know. If you could give one important tip to remember when hunting big river trout, say 7 pounds and over, what would that one item be?
The one tip for hunting 7-pound fish. The best thing that you can do for yourself to be able to successfully land a fish over 7 pounds is time when you're going to be on the water. The most important thing. You can be on the water and it could be one fish that you try your hardest. You could be in the water when there's no fish, but timing is, without question, the most important thing because those fish aren't always in the waterway, and being able to be there at the right time is going to give you a shot at the fish. Now, when the fish is in the river, and the best way to have a shot at that trout is to analyze the situation. Think about how you're going to approach the fish once you see the fish. So if I'm walking upstream, and I see a 7-pound fish in the middle of the run, the first thing I'm going to do is drop down to one knee. I'm going to look around at my surroundings upstream, downstream. I'm going to try to figure out where to cast from. I'm going to slowly creep up on the fish from behind so the fish cannot detect me. And then I'm going to watch the fish. I think one of the biggest things that you can do to help yourself and maybe be successful in catching the 7-pound fish is to watch the fish's behavior. How is the fish feeding? How is the fish holding? Is the fish territorial? Is it moving side to side? Is it holding still? Is it suspended in the middle of the river? Is it on the river bottom? So I would say, with all that knowledge I just mentioned, the most important thing is to, once you find the fish, watch the fish and read its movements before you react.
Okay, great tip. Tell me this. Let's say you're observing a fish. You can't really identify him specifically, but the fish rises occasionally. Can you determine the size of a fish from the rise form?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A good example of that is using your ears instead of your eyes. If you're fishing in a pod of, let's say you're fishing a trico spinnerfall, and there's a pod of 30 fish rising in front of you, and all the fish are tipping and sipping. They're coming up and sipping off the surface. Just a real gradual, subtle rise. And every now and again, you hear the whoop, thump. That's the big round in the bunch. Because its kite is so big and extended, you know that thump is one of the larger trout in the run. You can also do it by the size of the head when it's coming out of the water. You can also determine that by the amount of bubbles and the size of the ring that's left after the rise, because every time a trout rises, there is a bubble or a series of bubbles that are left on the water's surface.
It sounds like, Landon, you've spent a lot of time just looking at fish.
Yes, I have.
Rather than fishing, yeah. I mean, and that's the only way you're going to learn those things.
It is, and you know, that's one of the things that looking at the fish before you fish to them, I think a majority of anglers would be surprised how much more you will learn after you land the fish. Because then after you land the fish, you analyze the situation. You say, okay, why was that fish acting that way? Why was he willing to eat my fly? Why was he moving so far to take the naturals, and why was he not taking my imitation? Those type of questions and that type of buildup is what's going to make you come home, and it's going to pick at your brain until you finally have that light bulb go off and you figure it out. That's how you become a better angler. The best anglers are the ones who go to the water and learn something new every day.
Well, one more question before we go to break. You had just mentioned, you know, the big fish coming up on the hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions we had was, do hatches significantly affect very large trout's feeding habits, or do they stay with the big food regardless? In other words, it sounds from what you're saying that they're up there feeding on those small trichos along with everybody else and not just sitting on the bottom waiting for a big, another trout to come by to eat.
Yeah, it's both. If there's a PMD hatch coming off and you know, every 5 to 8 feet there's a dun PMD floating downstream, the large trout's going to stay in subsurface conditions and eat because there's going to be more food supply. If there's thousands of tricho spinners on top of the surface floating downstream that don't have a chance to escape, the fish is going to come up and rise. And the thing to remember about trophy trout is that trophy trout are more willing to come up and eat something off the surface if it is dead and it does not have a chance to escape or it's very slow moving. A caddis is not a good fly to fish for trophy trout with because there's a very good chance that the caddis is going to bounce off the surface and escape. Same thing with a dun. A dun has a chance when it's laying its eggs to fly away. Unlike a mouse or a grasshopper that is simply stuck on the surface, fluttering or skimmering and making a lot of racket and commotion, the trout knows it's wounded, the trophy trout knows it's wounded, and that's going to be an easy meal or easy food source because it's not going to escape. If it is going to get escape, the fish doesn't want to expend the energy, and it'd rather stay in its subsurface conditions to feed.
All right. Well, gentlemen, let's take a very brief break here. When we return, Landon Mayer will be answering more of your questions about how to hook those elusive and selective trophy trout.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Landon Mayer about fly fishing for monster trophy trout. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive the question promptly, and we're trying to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Landon, let's move on into the subject of diet. What exactly can you give us in terms of a generalization about how big fish eat?
Large trout, trophy trout in particular, in my opinion, prefer large protein food supplies. Taylor River in Gunnison, Colorado has Micey shrimp. Micey shrimp has a high protein food source that the fish can feed on. The Ozark fishery has shad that are killed when they come through the generated dams and float downstream, and that's an easy food source for trophy trout or stockfish that are put into the waterway. When you're dealing with trophy trout, think about large food supplies as far as mice, hoppers, baitfish, shad, anything that the fish can key in on, and it's going to be replenished with nutrients once it gains that food source. But also, don't forget to match the food source that's in the river, because these fish will adapt in any river or any environment they're in. after steelhead spawn in the spring, before they migrate back to the ocean, they're going to have to feed on the food supply that's in the water at that time. Here's another example of that. For fish that migrate up out of a large body of water like a reservoir, don't be afraid of using a larger fly. Fish in reservoirs are used to eating calabatus or chironomids, size 12 to 16. They're familiar with those flies, so when they do enter a river system that they are not going to reside in all year, don't shy away from imitating their natural food source that they will feed on in the reservoir. So I think when you're dealing with matching what food to imitate for trophy trout, think about the area you're fishing and think about the fish's opportunity to gain enough protein to sustain its size and not have to worry about expending too much energy.
Landon Mike Bank from Denver, Colorado. His question says, I've heard that fish undergo a change in mindset from hunting traditional bugs in the water to becoming carnivores, hunting other fish. Can you explain why this occurs? And I think you've kind of talked about that already. They need, you know, more protein. And at what stage or length, you know, does the trout start moving more towards that kind of food source?
That's a great question. But while I was researching for the book, I asked numerous fishery biologists that question, and then most of them came up with the answer that they believe when a trout reaches the length of 14 to 16 inches, something within its pituitary gland, hormonal change, makes the fish become more aggressive and more of a predatory eater. It's not going to rely on the insects as much, and it needs something bigger with more protein to sustain size and to grow larger. So I think that length of 14 to 16 inches is when they really make that transition. As far as an example of rainbow versus brown trout, I do not believe that the 14 to 16 inch browns are going to immediately become nocturnal feeders. I think that a lot of trout nocturnally feed, not just browns, and especially now because of how many anglers there are pursuing trout, especially trophy trout, worldwide. I think rainbows, cutbows, cutthroats and browns, brookies, mackinaw, a lot of these fish become nocturnal feeders because they can ambush prey and they don't have to worry about anything from above. There's no eagle that's going to crash down and grab them out of the water. There's no angler that's going to cast overhead. They don't feel any pressure. And unpressured feeding behavior is so much different from pressured feeding behavior. It's tremendous, the difference there.
Okay. We have an extension of Mike's question from Kevin Brady in Pennsylvania. He's wondering about these big carnivores. Have you used any of these new gummy minnows that are becoming kind of popular for larger fish?
I have not yet. My go-to flies for something similar to the gummy minnow has been the slump buster for me. The gummy minnow is something I'm going to try and something I think would work very well just because of how it looks with the streamlined profile. I think it's important for anglers to remember that when you pick up these streamers out of the box, while they look big and buggy, the most important thing is how they look when they're wet and the motion they have in the water. And the closer you can get to that streamlined profile, which a bait fish looks like, and the better action you can get out of it while it's in that streamlined profile, it's going to make you be more successful. So I definitely think that, that's going to be a hot fly and a hot pattern used for years to come, to especially to fool trophy trout, because it does look so much like their natural food source or something that they would prey on.
Sure. Landon, I missed the name of your go-to fly.
My go-to fly for years, as far as imitating, similar to the gummy minnow. Gummy minnow has a nice slim profile, just like a baitfish. And the one streamer I've been using over the years that does the same thing when it's wet is John Barr's Slump Buster. Has a nice action on the tail. It's got the nice shiny belly. It's got the cone head. And when it gets wet, it's got that streamlined profile and the action like an injured baitfish in the water. I found that streamlined profile with the action to outfish a woolly bugger 10 to 1, to outfish a big, bulky, rubber lake streamer 10 to 1. You know, you can imitate bait fish that way. You can imitate leeches that way, depending on the color. You can make it move certain ways to where it's really active and alive, or you can just let it dead drift where it's almost dead, dying. Or, you know, there's so many ways that you can present these flies to the fish if they have the streamlined profile to where it's going to give you a better opportunity at the trout committing to take the fly.
Sure. And John Barr has a book out discussing his patterns.
Absolutely, yeah, Barr flies. You bet.
Yeah. We've got a question from Jake in Kansas. When we're talking about big flies for big fish, what makes your light line techniques advantageous over heavier tackle with these big flies?
It's, you know what, there's no better way to pursue the trophy trout. I mean, shoot, I love throwing streamers with zero X. I mean, the tug is the drug, and having the monster trout come up and crash my streamer is huge. The reason I emphasize a lot on light tackle with small flies is because that's going to test every bit of your technique from beginning to end, whether it's presentation and, more importantly, during the fight. Being able to land a 10-plus pound trout in 5 to 7 minutes and watch it swim away healthy is going to allow you to have better technique in the future. And I believe that that fish will eat these natural food sources more so than they're apt to chase something in the waterway during normal hour conditions. Now, when you're dealing with cloudy conditions, early morning, late evening, or night, that's a different ball game. That's when the fish don't feel pressure. That's when they're ready to go after the big meal, the big ticket, and that's when using larger flies with heavier tippets is going to become an advantage. In fact, I like to fish every river when I'm pursuing trophy trout both ways. I normally pursue with light tackle, or light as possible, with imitating natural food sources. And I also oftentimes will fish it with streamers, imitating a large food source with an aggressive take. I like to do that in most areas I fish just so I can learn more at each waterway, but it increases my chances of catching a trophy trout as well, because if the fish is not keen in on natural food source and it does want that big meal ticket, then I'm going to be on point to cast that streamer.
Well, we do have several questions about types of the larger flies here, and I don't know, maybe we can hit a bunch of them together, mm-hmm. but questions like, you know, the use of eggs, San Juan worms, crawdads, you know,
hoppers,
you know, other terrestrials, probably like, you know, crickets or cicadas. Are those all good patterns to attract the larger trout?
They are, and one of the best ways to determine that is to know the environment that you're fishing. Investigate the water. For example, one of our reservoirs has an enormous supply of crayfish, and you can go up there all day long, cast crayfish, and oftentimes you won't hook anything because the fish are so keyed in on eating the natural food sources. But the only way to know that is to try. I think some of the most overlooked patterns or imitations as far as food supplies are crane fly larvae, which is a huge protein source in many waterways throughout many states. Crayfish patterns, crayfish imitations, highly overlooked. Sow bugs versus scuds. So many people are so apt to go fish a scud, and in that same river, in that same waterway, there'll be thousands of sow bugs. So I think it's just important to know your surroundings, know the environment as far as the river you're fishing, and try to pursue with those. I do think that a bait fish will outfish a crayfish on an even scale, just because the bait fish is more common than a crayfish would be to a trophy trout. A scud would be more prevalent in a waterway than a crane fly to a trophy trout. But because of these trophy trout don't see as many crane flies or crayfish or sow bugs, they're more apt to eat them because it's something new and they have not become conditioned to the fly.
Is it easier for them to take a bait fish than, say, a crawdad?
Not necessarily. I would say it might even be, it depends on the bait fish. If the bait fish is damaged, as far as being injured, then it's going to be easier to get the bait fish. If the bait fish is in the school, it's going to be easier because they can crash into the school. The one advantage you have with crayfish is that crayfish tend to move back slower and then they drop back down. So they pulsate up real quick and then drop back down. Well, when they drop back down to hide on the bottom, that's the fish's cue to come in and attack. And you don't get as much of that when you're fishing the bait fish as you do with the crayfish patterns.
Landon, we have a question about whether you recommend fishing specific hatches to increase your chances for the really big fish, like the salmon fly hatch or the green drake or the hopper season or that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a great question. The stonefly hatch, absolutely. That is one of those hatches where trophy trout will come up to take a dry fly off the surface of the water, and they know it's going to be a big meal ticket. They can see it, you know, a mile away, and once it's there and it's stuck and it's fluttering, they know it's not going to go, you know, it's not going to escape. Another big hatch, I think that's very important for trout is trichos. If you have a spinner fall of any type, that's very important food source and hatch to fish for trophy trout, just because those fish know those mayflies are not going to escape, they're dead. And, you know, green drakes and PMDs are a little bit harder to time just because the hatches tend to be sparse.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have as many bugs coming downstream to make it worth the trout's while to come up and take the fly.
Dead flies and foam lines.
That's right. Foam lines the ticket.
Yep.
Foam
okay.
lines don't lie.
That's right. Okay, here's an interesting question from Anthony Alpert in California. He's
okay.
a dry fly fishing addict.
Awesome.
And he wonders what your experience has been on dries and big trout. Do you match the hatch exactly? Do you go smaller, larger, or just go with a different fly, or do you just blow it all off and throw out a stimulator or a golden stone nymph?
Excellent, excellent. That's excellent question, and kudos to him because that's great observation and wondering what's going on. When in doubt, if you're having trouble with fish eating your dries, when in doubt, sink it. And what I mean by that is fish it in the film. A lot of these flies that float downstream, what we visibly see is the adult. What we visibly see is the alive bug. We don't see the dead spinners as well. We don't see the crippled as well. Here's an example. Roger Hill, who had written a book in the past on the South Platte River, had a pattern in there called the devil bug, which was a caddis that is basically stuck in its chuck or suspended. And the fish would know during the caddis hatch that that is not going to escape, and they would key in on it for sure. So when in doubt, sink it. But also, just try to read what's going on as far as the hatch is concerned, how many bugs are floating downstream, what bug, you know, if you have a complex hatch, which bug out of that complex hatch is going to be the most abundant to the trout, and that's going to be the one to key in on. And most importantly, the first and most important thing when it comes to dry flies, from what I've experienced with myself and my clients, size first, color second. If you're oversizing your dries, they won't touch them. If you undersize your dry, they'll eat it all day. If the color is close, you'll have a good shot. If the color is way off, you won't have a shot at all. So size is the most important thing. Color is the second most important thing.
Very interesting, very interesting. Well, Landon, when we return, we'll answer some more questions, maybe move on to equipment, talk about any specific equipment selections you might make, and then we'll spend the rest of the time talking about presentation and landing and fighting the fish. So
awesome.
When we get back, we'll get into those subjects.
Sounds great.
Have you ever dreamed about the classic action of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rod? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods, to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all.
visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's powerfibers.com for more information. We hope to hear from you soon.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Landon Mayer about fly fishing for big, huge, monster trophy trout. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, talking about equipment, people would like to know how you rig up leader, tippet. And in fact, we just got a question in online from Robert in Woodland Park. How often do you use fluorocarbon tippet when fishing for trophy trout? Are there situations where you always or never use it? Let's start out with that.
That's a great question. I always use fluorocarbon, except when I'm fishing dry flies. And when I'm fishing dry flies, I'll use a monofilament leader and attach fluorocarbon tippet. But I do use fluorocarbon almost all the time because it's abrasion resistant and non-reflectant of light versus the monofilament. I think that makes a huge difference. I've tested it on the water with clients. I've had clients rig monofilaments with the exact same rig, same flies, same run, have them cast into the run, and then have them switch and throw in fluorocarbon and see the difference, and the fish do not spook as much when you're dealing with fluorocarbon. The strength is better, it's not reflective of light, and when the fish tries to wrap you around a rock, you have a better shot when you're using fluorocarbon.
Well, now, you said something, you use monofilament when you're doing dries, but a fluorocarbon tippet?
Yeah. I use fluorocarbon tippet just because fluorocarbon has a tendency to sink when it's on the surface of the water. But I like to add a fluorocarbon tippet to my dry fly leader just so the fish won't shy away from reflection of light when it's subsurface or when it's floating in the film.
Ah, so you're using the leader to stay on top and then...
Right.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, and then what about other, anything particular about how you rig up your leader tippet, pretty conventional in that regard?
Fairly conventional. A couple things I've been using the last, you know, 3 or 4 years that's worked well is a technique from my good friend John Barr, the hopper copper dropper, using a natural dry on top, dropping one or two imitations below, that will a lot of times outfish any situation when you're dealing with suspended fish because your flies will float in the middle of the water column rather than towards the bottom. Whenever I'm using fluorocarbon to fluorocarbon, I use a triple surgeon's knot instead of a double surgeon's knot because it is so abrasion resistant. It doesn't cinch down as well, so that makes a difference so your knots don't come loose. I tend to use 9-foot leaders, 18 inches between two flies, or 18 inches to one fly. And I'm constantly, this is very important, I'm constantly checking my rig after I land a fish or after I'm fishing, if I'm scraping bottom or anything such of that nature, just to make sure that if I do hook that trophy, it won't break off from something that could have been prevented by simply changing out my rig.
Okay. Tell us about your rod or what you recommend people use on big fish.
Fast action rods are great for getting lifting power on the trout when it comes to fighting the fish. Supple tip or slower medium fast action rods are great when you're dealing with individuals who don't have as much experience because faster rods, I like faster rods because I can lift up on the fish, but the disadvantage to that is that you can break fish off because you don't have as much bend in the tip. If you don't have as much experience going after trophy trout, a medium fast action rod is great because you get strength out of the butt section, the lower section of the rod, but the tip of the rod is soft enough to absorb the pressure of the fish when it's head shaking or running away from you.
Okay. Now we have a question from George in Monument, and I suspect that's Monument, Colorado. He's noticed some difficulty using a 10-foot rod that's more of a medium action and setting the hook. Do you have any recommendations along those lines to get that hook set?
Yeah, you know, and he might want to try a couple techniques. Longer rods, it's harder to set the hook because there's more flexing from the graphite that has to be performed. There's more graphite that has to move, more graphite that has to bend. If he's conventionally lifting up on the fish, try lifting sideways or downstream on the fish. What that's going to do is instead of relying on the rod flex to penetrate the trout's mouth with the fly, it's going to, if you set sideways and downstream, it's the resistance and the tension of the line on the water that's going to put the penetration on the trout's mouth. So setting downstream sideways will help him get more hookups with a longer rod.
Yeah. Is that also possibly a place for a sweep strike?
Absolutely, yeah. You bet.
Okay.
Absolutely. And a lot of individuals are using 10-foot rods because they get more line control. They have a chance of landing fish faster because there's more graphite to fight the fish. But a disadvantage to a longer rod, which isn't mentioned often, is that a lot of the tailwater fisheries or a lot of small water fisheries, it makes it very difficult to control the short game. A lot of the waters that I fish and a lot of the tailwaters in the west and the east, creeks, tributaries, whatever it may be, you're only casting 10 feet, and when you have more rod, it's going to be harder to only push that 10 feet of line out there as far as having control. So you just need to judge your length of rod and what waterway you're fishing to make it better for you and to give you the advantage.
Lennon, let's move on and talk about presentation a little bit more specifically.
You bet.
Let's say, and you addressed this a little bit earlier, but let's do a pretend here.
Okay.
You know, you've used the viewing lane, you've spotted a fish out there, it's a big fish. Number one, how do you know if it's feeding? And then secondarily, what's your approach to that fish?
Okay, great question. If it's feeding, the fish is going to either be opening its mouth, you'll see the white of its mouth, you'll see movements. A lot of people do not realize that a trout, before it eats, even if it's subtle, a majority of the time they drift back before they take the fly. I think that's just to get a secondary look or just to investigate it a little bit longer. If the fish is feeding, the best way to approach the situation is to cast short of the trout first, give the fish a chance to move to take your fly. If the fish is not willing to move to take your fly, then try to get the fly within the trout's feeding lane, wherever you're casting from. A good example of this is if you're in a shallow riffled run and you're casting to a fish and the water's only a foot and a half deep and you're worried about spooking the fish if you're casting from downstream or you're casting sideways. Go upstream at an exaggerated 45-degree angle, cast out across stream, upstream of the fish about 10 feet and probably 5 feet past the trout, and allow your flies to swing down into front of the fish in its viewing lane, giving it a chance to take your fly. That's going to help you out in many situations, and honestly, that upstream casting down to the trout will give the first thing that's visible to the trout is going to be your flies, and that will give you a huge advantage for the fish committing to take your fly because it's not going to see anything unnatural like your split shot, leader, or fly line. I see a lot of individuals casting dry flies to fish from a downstream casting up to the trout. That does work if you have a long leader or you can do a reach cast, but you'll have more success if the first thing the trout sees is your flies from upstream than you would at any other position.
That's interesting because you do have an advantage from behind in that they can't see you as well.
Right.
But the presentation is probably easier from upstream.
That's true, but always remember this as well. You have an advantage from them not seeing you from behind, but when you're casting, let's say for an example, a dry fly, if you're behind or below the trout and you're false casting, as soon as your line hovers above the fish, if there's movement, shadow, a glint of light, that could be a talon off of an eagle, that is a chance to spook the fish. If you're upstream from the trout, you don't have that chance of spooking the fish because it won't have the chance to detect that movement as well.
It's also interesting up on the South Platte when we were watching the Fly Fishing Championship last year. We were standing on the bridge looking down into the Platte,
right.
And there were two trout in just off the seam of a current, you know, in the calmer water. And you talk about movement and watching that moving. We were looking down, so it was like clear as day, you know, seeing these trout. Of course, on the river, it's harder to see them. But in looking down, it was so interesting because they were sitting there just off the seam in the calm water. And then every few seconds, they just stick their nose out in the current, grab something, go back. Stick their nose
exactly.
out, come back.
Yeah.
Stick their nose out,
yeah.
come back.
Right.
And that taught me a lot about, you know, how to work those seams and how those fish are sitting in there.
Absolutely.
Because they were actually going into the strong current to get the bug and then going back into the
right.
soft area.
And that right there is such a key factor in why sight fishing is so important, because that gave you a chance to see how the trout was feeding off of that seam, which allowed you to make your presentation more acceptable to the trout to make it look natural. If you would have just gone into that run, cast it upstream, thrown a big mend or high stick the run, you would have no idea how the trout was feeding in the run beforehand. So that's the investigation beforehand, watching the trout and knowing that the trout's feeding this way, so this is how I have to present my flies. And there's a lot of things, like one of the tips and tricks I like to show my clients is when a fish sees a fly come downstream and it turns sideways, or it even comes back and swoops back around to come take a fly, I always tell my clients, if you can't see the white of the trout's mouth, how do you set the hook? Wait until the trout straightens out, then set the hook. Because once the trout is straightened out, if it's moved sideways, then it's clamped its jaws down on your fly, and you'll be able to penetrate the corner of its mouth.
All right. Here's an interesting flurry of questions. These are generated from the Midwest and the South, and they all relate to how you make a presentation to big fish in deep water, whether it's fast or slow, and how you detect a take on, say, a nymph or whatever.
Okay. Deep water, the way I like to approach deep water, if I can see the fish, or even if I can't see the fish, but I know that it's got cover, oxygen, and food supply in that run, is I always like to think of starting light and then go deep. I always start light instead of putting on a bunch of split shot. I see a lot of anglers go to an 8 to 10 foot run. While they're in that 8 to 10 foot run, they're going to go deep with a lot of weight and try to get it right on the bottom because they think all the fish are deep down in there feeding. What I like to do is just use the system with split shot. I'll put one shot on. I try to hit the top column. If I'm not getting a strike on the top column, I'll put another shot on and I'll try to hit mid column. If I don't get a hit mid column, I'll try to put another shot on and go down deeper. And then if I can see the fish in the run, I'll give the fish a chance, especially trophy fish, to come up and take the fly from the middle of that deep run when they're sitting on the bottom. And the last resort, if they're not coming up or they're not moving, they're hunkered right down on the bottom, I'll simply drift my flies in front of the fish and almost try to swing them to the side short of the fish and give the fish a chance to open its mouth and slightly turn to take the fly. That's a great way to fish, especially during spring months when you're dealing with big rainbows. The females love to sit on the bottom of the deep runs and feed. They don't like to move. The males are up in the shallows. They're biting each other. They're fighting. They're territorial. The females are just lying nice and calm right on the bottom. What I like to do is drift my flies right above them and gradually work my way down. Once I think I've reached the water depth where they're holding, I'll cast short of the trout, even if it's short of the trout by 8 inches, and give that fish a chance to kick over just 8 to 6 inches, open its mouth, and take the fly. And that system has worked so well, especially for those deep females and the big females in the deep runs.
Well, Landon, we're getting short on time here, but before we talk about fighting and landing, because we've got some very good questions on the survival of fish and so forth that we want to address. But in the presentation, can you explain, because you talk about this in your video and you talk about it in your book, your dotted line presentation technique for both shallow and deep water?
Yeah, the dotted line technique is basically, it's a simple way to accurately get a cast to the trout every time you're on the water. Basically, you want to make an imaginary line above the fish. The imaginary line above the fish for shallow water can be 3 to 4 feet. For deep water, it can be 8 to 10 feet. From that imaginary line, you now have a target area of where your fly should land. Now, where your fly should land is based on where the split shot hits, if you're using weight or weighted flies, or where the dry fly lands. And the thing to remember when you're using the dotted line is you don't want to cast directly on the line. You want to cast slightly past. Because when you're standing on the river's edge or you're floating in a river, your flies are naturally drifting back towards you or back towards the boat. They don't sink directly down at a 90-degree angle. The way to approach the dotted line technique is the first thing, determine your distance as far as length of line. Cast downstream of the fish so you don't spook the fish. Once you think you have the right amount of line out, then you pick up once using a steeple cast and then make your presentation above the fish. This way you're not going to spook the fish by false casting or spook the fish by tapping the water or shooting it in the wrong area. If you're short, let it drift past, allow the fish to move. If you're long, strip some line in to adjust and then try to line it up with that imaginary line and let it drift to the fish.
Sounds good. You make it sound simple. Not so simple all the time, though, is it?
It's not, and that's one of the biggest things is, you know, practice makes perfect. No angler on the water knows everything, and I always try to learn something new every day. And just like they say, the difference between a good angler and an expert angler is one split shot. The most important thing an angler can do on the river is be able to adjust and adapt for any situation in any environment. That's going to make you a better angler on the water.
Good point. Okay, well, let's talk about fighting and landing these fish, these big guys, once you've hooked them. And we're going through a little bit of an unusual circumstance in Montana, but it's not unique in that we have low water flows and high air temperatures, which are resulting in high water temperatures, and that's of course very hard on the trout, especially if they're hooked and fought. Tell us your technique for bringing in a fish quickly and how you gauge your behavior in that landing process.
Well, absolutely. I think it's important first off to know the reaction of the fish when you first hook them. Any fish that's hooked, its first reaction, whether it's subtle, whether it's exaggerated, is a head shake. And then a head shake is followed by a series of runs. So those runs can be a brown trout trying to dog down and touch its nose on the bottom, or a rainbow blasting off in a run. Adjusting for those simple movements right off the bat is very important. You can do so by using your body as an extension of your rod. If the fish head shakes, allow your arm to be pulled down for every head shake. The fish runs across stream or makes a dart or a dash, drop your rod tip to nearly horizontal and allow your expensive drag to do the work. The best way to get the fish in quickly is to maintain maximum pressure above the trout's head. And the reason that gets the fish in quickly is because it causes the trout to head shake. Trout, especially trophy trout, do not tire out simply by moving their tail side to side and thrusting their tail. They can thrust their tail 3 or 4 times and move 20 feet. When they have these large bodies, 30 inches plus, and their head is almost touching their tail for every head shake, that's what tires the fish out quickly. So being able to stay on top of the fish, keep the upward pressure, move upstream or downstream of the fish, is going to allow you to get that fish in fast, especially in warm water conditions, where you don't hurt the fish. If you're dealing with really fast water, try to stay with the fish running up or downstream and keep sideways pressure if the fish is way out in the run to try to move it into slower water. Because a lot of times people will hook fish in fast currents and the fish is done fighting, but they keep their rod placed to where the fish is still drifting in the fast water instead of moving their rod tip to the edge of the water where they're standing, getting the fish in the shallower water where they're not going to be as exhausted. And the second thing, you know, and one of the most important things is when you get the fish in, how you handle the fish. Once the fish is netted, you know, if you want to take your trophy shot or you want to length or girth or scale the fish, do so quickly. You can measure the fish while you're reviving it in the water. You always want to start that reviving process immediately. In between photographs, revive the fish. The best photos and the ones that the magazines prefer to take are the photographs where the water's dripping off the fish, because they know that fish is being revived and was quickly picked up to take the shot. But always try to stay above the fish, follow the fish up and downstream. I call that walking the dog. Just like when you're trying to train a new puppy, you always want to keep it next to you and tell it to heel. The less line you have out, the more control you have over the fish, the more you can keep the pressure above its head, get that fish to head shake, tire out quickly, and then get him into the net and let him live to fight another day.
One final question on that, Landon. Gary in Missouri asks, is there any preset criteria for too long a fight? You ever just break them off to save the fish?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're dealing with a fish that, let's say, for example, you hook a 10-pound fish in really fast water, if you know the fish is fair hooked, the fish is fighting you, you know, it's gone past 5, 7, 8 minutes, fight the fish a little longer. Once you start going past that 10-minute mark on a big fish, in my opinion, that's when it's time to start thinking about breaking the fish off, just because you could hurt the fish and the fish might not have a chance to live. And that also brings up another good point. If you're fighting a fish that's foul hooked, if you know it's foul hooked, instead of trying to bring a foul hooked fish in that, you know, let's use the example again, 10 pounds, instead of trying to bring in the 10-pound foul hooked fish, break it off. As soon as you know it's foul hooked, break it off. And if you do have a fish of that size and you've been fighting it for 20 minutes, if you're not fishing steelhead or you're not fishing waterways where that's common, break the fish off, because more often times than not, the fish is foul hooked. And if you do get them in and you release them after you've fought them for 20 minutes and they swim away, they're not going to have a chance to move that lactic acid buildup out of their gills, and they're going to die 5 minutes downstream and you won't even know it.
Very good. Very good tips on that. I'm sure we all appreciate your concern for the fish, and that's a hard thing to do, but the right thing
to
do.
It is. It's a hard thing. Yeah. That's definitely a test of judgment right there. Test
right,
of character.
Right. Exactly. Well, we've had a great show, Landon, here. Unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up again, and things have to move rather fast at the end, but we'll come back to you in just a minute. Because we're going to give away your autographed copy of your book, for one.
Awesome.
And, also,
awesome.
That 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and the Fly Fusion magazine. So, everybody, stay tuned for a few more minutes to see if you win.
Fly tires, are you looking for better thread control when you're tying up those number 20 parachute atoms or spinning deer hair? Are you breaking thread, tightening down on those big saltwater streamers? The right bobbin is your answer. That's R-I-T-E bobbin. It's the only adjustable thread tension bobbin on the market today. Just dial in the tension 1 ounce at a time and kiss broken thread goodbye. Professional fly tires worldwide are enjoying perfect thread control for all their patterns. For details, go to our website, www.rightbobbins.com. That's RITEbobbins.com. Right Bobbins, sold at dealers worldwide. From our global events calendar, we see the Denver Trout Unlimited is sponsoring the South Platte Pro-Am Carp Slam, hosted by Barry Reynolds on August 4th. This first annual event is being held to raise money for rehabilitation of the South Platte River as it runs through Denver. Go to the global events calendar on our website. The link is near the bottom of each page on our site. Look under the U.S., then Colorado for more information. Fly shops, clubs, you can list all your events related to fly fishing on our global events calendar. It's free. You do it yourself. Go to the events calendar and get started. Get your events out there for everyone to see. Classes, demos, clinics, shows, schools, anything related to fly fishing. We'll be highlighting one event from the calendar on each of our shows.
Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link, leave a few comments there, and we'd sure appreciate it. Now it's time to give away Landon's book, How to Catch the Biggest Trout of Your Life. And if you've listened tonight, you're going to want that book because there's a lot more in there that we didn't get to cover, that's for sure. So the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from tonight's registration database. So if you didn't register already, then it's too late. I'm sorry, but make sure you do for next show because we're always giving away great, great gifts like we are tonight. Well, Landon, let's do your book first, and we have the magic button here. You tell me when, and I'll click it, and that'll be it.
Let's go ahead and click it.
Okay, there we are. And the winner is Vaughn Miller in Oregon.
Awesome.
Vaughn Miller in Oregon. So congratulations, Vaughn.
Congratulations.
Yeah, you'll love this book, and it's sure to help you catch bigger trout, I'm sure. Okay, so then, and thanks, Landon, for offering that book tonight.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate that.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Now, let's pick a winner for a three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is another great gift.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that will be Kip Russell in Colorado. Not sure where in Colorado, but in Colorado. So, Kip.
Congratulations.
The West is doing well today.
Pardon me?
The West is doing well.
The West is doing well. Okay. Well, let's see if we can get one in the East. I don't know. One more time for Fly Fusion Magazine. And, well, we went a little further east. It's Tom Quayle in Michigan. Tom Quayle in Michigan. So congratulations, everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me on the program. And I hope any of this information can help any anglers out there. My book and DVD are available now, and all the information is in the book and the DVD. And you can reach me at my website, Landon, www.landonmayer.com. And I promote this program, and I hope other anglers do as well, because it's a great way to get great information from sources from all over and make everybody better anglers and have a better time on the water.
Well, we sure appreciate you taking your time and sharing your experience and knowledge with us, because I, for one, learned a ton tonight, and I bet everybody in the audience did.
I hope so. That's great to hear.
Well, just want to make a note. Last week I had told you that Don was kind of in and out of our hosting situations here. He's been very busy out in the fly fishing world, and we'll be coming back as a guest host like tonight and doing a little on the stream reporting for us, but won't be around as much as he used to be. But Don, tell us what's going to be taking up your time coming up here, and give us kind of a brief overview of what's going on in your life.
I'd be happy to. I'll tell you, when Roger approached me with the concept of this show, I was greatly impressed, and I've got to tell you that Roger puts an enormous amount of time in to get this finished product that you listen to and seem to enjoy so much. And from my standpoint, I have particularly enjoyed meeting the different folks we've had for guests, but also just folks in the fly fishing world, the trade, as well as people out on the streams, and that part has really been very dear to my heart. But I've really got some things that I get a kick out of doing, and one of them is the kind of volunteering things that I'm able to do through some of the local clubs, and you know, introducing people to the world of fly fishing with fly tying classes or fly casting or just general discussions about fly fishing. And while I'm at it, I want to say a special hello to the fly casting and fly tying stars at Camp Make a Dream near Deer Lodge, Montana. These are some very special kids who have varying stages of some illnesses, and that kind of thing means an awful lot to me. Recently, I was also asked by the Federation of Fly Fishers to accept a position on their board, and in a position like that, I anticipate being able to work on behalf of fly fishers all over the world. But I want people to know that they can reach me through Don at askaboutflyfishing.com. If they have anything they'd like as far as input regarding this internet radio show or the website, but also in terms of anything that they would like the board of the Federation of Fly Fishers to consider I would very much like to be your conduit for those kinds of consideration. I'll still be involved, as Roger mentioned, doing special interviews. In fact, we've got one that's going to be coming up on the homepage shortly, revolving around some special equipment that the Flycasting Institute uses. And Roger and I will be down at the trade show in Denver in September. Lots of exciting things, but I'm branching out, and it'll be a treat every time I'm back on Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, for sure.
Don has made incredible contributions, and he's, you'll see, if you meet him, he's going to be talking about us, that's for sure. So, and he might even stick a microphone in front of you, so beware.
Yeah, come to the Federation Conclave in just a couple weeks, and I'll see you there.
Well, good. Well, our next broadcast will be on August 1st at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Wendy Gunn, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. Wendy Gunn's a professional guide on the Colorado River, and she'll introduce you to fly fishing Lee's Ferry, this tailwater just below Glen Canyon Dam, and at the start of the Grand Canyon is one of the most beautiful places on earth to fish. Be sure and listen in to learn Wendy's secrets to catching the trophy trout that make this place their home. We'd like to thank Mystic River on the Nantahala, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Power Fibers Online Magazine, and Wright Bobbins for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site, like the events calendar and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.